This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, July 26th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear about the Bureau of Land Management's ongoing roundup of wild horses in northwest Colorado. We'll also visit with an artist teaming up with local farmers to reach across the table with the wisdom of an old parable. And when going outside, how hot is too hot? That story and more in This Week in Water. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. And then it's How on Earth? Host Susan Moran will be live in the studio to discuss the Colorado River water crisis, the science, the politics, and the potential solutions. At 9 a.m. comes Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker, known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, Joanne Cole will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's James Swenson.
Officials say they are investigating a woman found dead Sunday morning at Realization Point Trailhead on Flagstaff as a homicide. Police have not yet released the name of the victim, but say an investigation is underway. According to the Daily Camera, police say the victim and the suspect likely know each other. An Aurora man was sentenced on Thursday to 64 years to life for distributing fentanyl to a 16-year-old girl who died from an overdose at a party. According to the release, police were called to Alexander Chaquiab's house in August 2020 on a report of a potential overdose. The victim was pronounced dead at the scene. An investigation found that Chaquiab and another adult man had supplied alcohol, marijuana, and fentanyl to a group of teenage girls during a social gathering at his home. One of the girls appeared to be experiencing an overdose, but nobody attempted to seek emergency medical care for her, the release said. The next morning, the girl was found unresponsive and 911 was called. Chaquiab was found guilty of manslaughter, two counts of distribution of a controlled substance to a minor, two counts of possession of a controlled substance with intent to distribute, sexual assault of a child, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and sexual assault. Great Outdoors Colorado recently awarded $3 million to expand efforts to preserve the state's iconic landscapes, wildlife habitat, and watersheds.
The Transaction Cost Assistance Program helps private landowners create easement agreements and leverage state tax credits. Eric Galatas has more.
Keep It Colorado has received $3 million in grants from Great Outdoors Colorado. According to Melissa Deruna, the group's executive director, some of that money will help fund a new round of conservation projects to protect more critical watersheds and wildlife habitat and support local food systems. She points to a recent easement at Edgerton Creek Ranch, part of a larger wildlife corridor in the Roaring Fork Valley. Deruna says the voluntary agreement allows family ranchers to continue working the land.
And then provide perpetual habitat protection for the wildlife that live there as well, including bald eagle, cutthroat trout, and a lot of big game species, including elk and moose, black bear, mule deer.
Last year, the group's Transaction Cost Assistance Program helped 8 Colorado land trusts complete 14 conservation projects, protecting more than 5,600 acres. The projects also helped landowners leverage more than $8 million in state tax credits. Landowners interested in exploring conservation are encouraged to contact their local land trust. More information is available at keepitco.org. I'm Eric Galatas.
The Regional Transportation District, or RTD, is offering free transit on buses and rail lines throughout the Front Range during the months of August. The initiative, called Zero Fare for Better Air, is the result of a Colorado Senate bill created to reduce ground-level ozone. According to the City of Boulder, almost 80% of greenhouse emissions from transportation comes from commuters. One car can create up to 20 pounds of CO2 emissions per day. Officials hope the program will convince commuters to use public transit as an alternative.
Volunteers in Boulder are helping the city collect data to combat extreme heat. KGNU Steve Miller has more.
The data that the volunteers collected last Friday recorded the time, the temperatures, and humidity for scientists tracking climate trends nationwide. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is leading the annual heat mapping project that helps communities combat extreme heat, which can have a greater impact on economically and socially vulnerable people. The annual project assesses the hottest and coolest parts of 14 U.S. cities and counties to help plan and prepare for the extreme heat waves scientists have been warning about for years. Adam Hall, a graduate student at the University of Colorado, studying urban resilience and sustainability, is helping to lead the local initiative. He said that they are looking at what areas of the city are hottest and then finding out why, like the lack of shade that tree coverage provides. Some volunteers attached heat sensors and then drove to designated areas of Boulder, trying to maintain a steady speed of 35 miles an hour to allow the heat sensors to work. Others biked or were on foot to collect the data. Hall said that they want to get people to start thinking about the relationship between heat and the built-in environment, and then propose solutions on how to cool those parts of the city. For KGNU, I'm Steve Miller.
Homeless Solutions for Boulder County, HSBC, is looking for landlords and rental property owners in Boulder County to provide housing opportunities to individuals experiencing homelessness. Owners who fill vacancies with participants in homelessness voucher programs may receive valuable incentives, including a limited-time Boulder Homeless Shelter cash bonus of $2,500. Property owners and community members are encouraged to help identify available rental units and contact Homeless Solutions for Boulder County. HSBC's evidence-based Housing First model prioritizes obtaining stable housing solutions as quickly as possible for individuals experiencing homelessness. Most clients matched to a housing opportunity have a team of staff working to end their experience of homelessness through guaranteed income, supportive case management, and landlord relations. According to recent census data, rates of homelessness have spiked in recent years. Denver area homelessness increased by close to 13% since 2020. Today there is a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly after 2 p.m. Mostly sunny with a high near 87. West wind 5 to 8 miles per hour, becoming northeast in the afternoon. For KGNU, I'm James Swenson.
You are listening to the Morning Magazine on KGNU. The Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, recently started rounding up wild horses on land in northwest Colorado. The agency cited the poor condition of the wild horses and the high numbers of horses roaming in the 190,000-acre Piance East Douglas herd management area. The Bureau of Land Management is seeking to remove more than 1,000 wild horses from the area, but wild horse advocates say the horses are not in poor condition and that cattle are causing more problems on the range than the horses. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, Aspen Public Radio's Haley Zander reports.
Earlier this month, a small group of scientists and wild horse advocates flew with the nonprofit EcoFlight over the rugged landscape southeast of Rangeley. EcoFlight brings policymakers, journalists, and advocates up in the air to view problems from a broader perspective. In this case, the passengers wanted to get a look at the wild horses before the BLM began using helicopters and horseback riders to drive and trap them. Delia Malone was on the flight. She's an ecologist and serves on the board of the Sierra Club's Colorado chapter. She's been evaluating habitats and endangered species on the western slope for decades.
And so I have something of a rather intimate knowledge of what's impacting the landscape and what's impacting the health of the land.
And she feels wild horses are part of a Western identity.
Wild horses exemplify the West. They are the spirit of the landscape. And BLM is set on destroying that spirit.
The BLM estimates nearly 1,400 horses now roam in the herd management area. But the agency determined in a 2021 environmental assessment that there should only be 135 to 235 horses in the area to maintain an ecological balance. That document gives them the authority to conduct this gather operation. But Malone disputes whether the BLM's limit of 235 horses in this herd management area is appropriate and questions the need to remove wild horses from the land.
In my opinion, as an ecologist, the impact that wild horses have on the landscape is minimal.
Eric Mulvar was on the EcoFlight plane with Malone. He's a wildlife biologist and the executive director of Western Watersheds Project, which works to protect western lands from what it calls, quote, the destructive effects of livestock grazing. After the flight over the management area, Mulvar said horses are not the problem there.
the livestock industry commonly scapegoats wild horses for rangeland degradation that's actually caused by cattle and sheep. And it's not just the livestock industry, it's the Bureau of Land Management.
Chris Maestas is a spokesperson for the BLM's Northwest Colorado District. He didn't speak to the claim about the BLM scapegoating wild horses, and Maestas pointed out the BLM has to balance the wild horse population in the herd management area with other uses, including oil and gas wells.
You have resource development, you have recreation, you have other wildlife animals, and so you have all these decisions that the BLM has to take into account and come up with the best decisions for the land.
But Mulvar, with the Western Watersheds Project, says cattle are harder on the environment than wild horses.
The cattle, in particular, concentrate along the lush bottomlands and near water. They have a disproportionate impact, a disproportionate forage removal right along the streams, right along the valley bottoms.
Mulvar says horses are similar to elk and bison in their grazing.
They're not concentrating in those riparian areas. They're spreading their impacts across a variety of habitats. They're wide-ranging. They use steep country. They don't avoid steep country the way cattle do.
Regardless, the BLM's environmental assessment says adjusting livestock use in the herd management area was outside the scope of their analysis. Ecologist Malone traveled to the herd management area earlier this month and walked around in areas where horses tend to congregate. She wrote a report that says most of the lowland areas near water sources are severely damaged because of cattle, and that upland habitats provide enough forage to support the wild horses.
And in my ecological perspective, it's the horses are not the problem. It's the cattle and the sheep that are severely damaging the landscape.
Malone's report also disputes other claims from the BLM. BLM assessments of the horses this spring showed they ranged from, quote, very thin to moderately fleshy, and about 90% of horses ranked somewhere in between. But Malone said the wild horses she saw and photographed were, quote, vigorous and reproductively successful. Photos of the horses from the BLM and Malone paint very different pictures of the health of the herd. So I'm looking at photos from the BLM, and I'm seeing some horses with pretty pronounced shoulders and neck bones, lots of visible rib cages. And in Malone's photos, the horses look pretty healthy, lots of round bellies and happy-looking foals. Governor Jared Polis also decided to weigh in earlier this spring. Governor Polis wrote letters in May and July asking the BLM to pause drive traps and consider the challenges that a midsummer gather could cause. But since the BLM is a federal agency, Governor Polis can only make requests and suggestions. Here's the BLM's Maestas.
So we appreciate the governor's involvement. Know that the BLM leadership is in frequent communication with the governor's office on ways to improve wild horse management in Colorado.
So the reasons for this gather operation remain disputed. Mulvar says when the facts on the ground are contested, it's difficult to have informed debates.
And it should be clear what's happening. I mean, there should be consensus. There should be broad agreement that, yeah, everybody can agree that, you know, these horses are in bad condition, or the range is in bad condition, or that the range condition problems are due to wild horses or they're due to cattle. But it seems like it's really difficult to drive that kind of consensus.
So while the rangeland conditions and the health of the wild horses are disputed, their fate has already been determined. Gather operations are ongoing, and as of Wednesday morning, roughly 400 wild horses were gathered, and over 300 of them have been shipped to a holding facility in Axtell, Utah, and about 100 are in a holding pen. Some will be sold or adopted, others will be boarded long-term, and some will be sterilized and released back onto the range. But the BLM says that rates of adoption and sales of wild horses have historically not kept up with the growth of their populations. So many of these horses will live out their lives in confined grazing areas. Hallie Zander, Aspen Public Radio News.
A new exhibit at the Longmont Museum brings together over 15 local and regional artists with Boulder County farmers to create and share connections with the land. During a recent ceramics workshop, KGNU's Rosana Longobetter spoke with artist Margarita Cabrera about how art has the power to transform social situations and bring ideas of community, kindness, and stewardship to better understand issues of food justice.
This project is inspired by the story of the long spoons. It's a historic parable that tells the story of heaven and hell, people in hell starving around a table with a very special feast in the middle in a bowl. And with very long spoons, they all reach for the food and try to feed themselves and cannot because the spoons are so long, they can't feed themselves successfully eat. So they are starving until one realizes that they can use the long spoon and reach across the table and feed the person in front. Then they start feeding each other and realize that that's what we need to do in order to all be saved, and eventually all of them leave heaven, right? I mean, leave hell to go to heaven. And so this story, this historic parable, inspires our actions today. This collaboration and partnership with the museum, with Eugene Farms, and myself as a community artist brings together the Longmont community to activate this story. It's a community collaboration. It's a workshop format project. It has two parts. The first part is this summer, where we come together with community members from different parts of Longmont, a very diverse community. And we are, welcome, come on in. Coming together to get to know our communities by sharing stories that connect us to the land, that connect us to our personal histories, our community's histories, all related to food, to art, to community, to agriculture, and ideas of art and food, essentially. And that's the first part, is the sharing and the sharing of stories and the creation of symbols that represent those stories that will then be represented in the decoration of these artistic sculptural spoons. They are going to be created, very long spoons, mm-hmm. like the ones in the story. And that's the first part of this project. The second part is those spoons are going to be activated in a community feast next summer, where we will bring together different community members to eat and drink together, but it will be an act of service. So you will be feeding people across the table with your long spoons, the long spoons created by the community, embellished with the community story. So it's created by the community, and in the end it will be for the community, because arts and stories and art and this activity is meant to surface or help us understand better our community's needs, our community's challenges. And so it's a way of using stories for a social justice effort.
Why are you choosing Olin Farms?
Olin Farms is a treasure in this community, the Longmont community. There's a couple and a family, strong, close-knit family that runs this farm, and all their friends and families, communities around them. They are such a gift and really should be supported as much as possible in their efforts to regenerate the land and teach others the importance of regenerating land and then, by extension, strengthening communities. They're also putting a lot of effort in education of future generations, and such a great example to the rest of the community of the sort of humanity and the labor effort that we all need to be a part of and support to be able to make our communities healthy. All of our communities, right? So dealing with ideas of food accessibility and dealing with soil regeneration and pollination, connecting those ideas with community needs is what you're going to see in Eugene Farms. And so we were invited to work with them, and what a wonderful pairing with our project, with the Spoons Project, because it's a perfect bridge to connect all the ideas that they're promoting and all the work they're doing and the ideas we're promoting. So working together, we're stronger together in promoting our message.
Margarita Cabrera, how can people find out more about this project and how can people participate in this?
Yes, you can see all the information for the two parts of this project on the Eugene Farm website and also the Longmont Museum of Art website. So information about exhibition dates and workshops can all be found there. And we hope that a lot of people participate, support, you know, and make this a success.
At Olin's Farm in Longmont. For KGNU, I am Rosana Longobeter.
Time now for the latest edition of This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
Going outside? How hot is too hot? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
President Joe Biden announced last week that climate change was an emergency and outlined executive actions to boost offshore wind energy and protect communities facing extreme heat.
Although he called the crisis a clear and present danger, he failed to formally declare a climate emergency, but suggested he might do so soon.
If he made the declaration, he could reinstate a ban on crude oil exports, which might cut greenhouse gas emissions equivalent to shutting down more than 40 coal plants.
He could also restrict imports and exports of all fossil fuels, halt investment in those projects overseas, and stop new oil and gas drilling in federal waters.
But those actions would not come close to the steps that were in the now-doomed Build Back Better climate package, which lacks the support of one critical member of Biden's own party, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia.
The effects of the possible emergency actions on climate change may not be significant, and opponents would try to block them in court. High gas prices also make it less likely the administration will put any limitation on fossil fuels.
Lake Mead, the nation's largest reservoir that sits on the Colorado River, is now lower than it's been since 1937, after Hoover Dam was completed and the lake began to fill.
Since last year, the lake has lost 27 feet and 45 feet since 2020. According to a new study, there will be much less predictability of when water will flow into rivers across the entire northern hemisphere, including the Colorado River.
For at least 100 years, the millions of people who rely on the Colorado River have depended upon a predictable amount of snowpack in western mountains to hold and release water into the river and to fill its reservoirs.
However, scientists from the National Center for Atmospheric Research conclude that with global warming, the flow of rivers and streams fed by snow will become more difficult to forecast. Earlier research has shown that water quantity will diminish, and this new research looks at increasing variability of when it will be available.
Many on Earth depend upon snow accumulation in winter, and it's melting in spring and summer to regulate the timing of stream flows. But snowpack will become thinner and go away faster as precipitation in colder months comes from rain rather than snow. At times, melting will actually occur during the winter instead of spring runoff.
This summer, hundreds of millions of people around the globe are feeling the effects of climate change. Last week in the U.S., more than half of states were under heat advisories, and 60 daily high temperature records were tied or broken.
Many humans are ill-prepared for the risk excessive heat will pose to their bodies, especially when combined with humidity.
When it gets hot, we sweat to cool down because evaporating water moves heat away from our skin. But if the air is humid, the process slows down, and the point at which heat combined with humidity becomes dangerous is measured as the wet bulb temperature.
Scientists have agreed that a wet bulb temperature, when it's 95 degrees Fahrenheit, with 100% humidity, would make it nearly impossible for sweat to evaporate, risking heat stroke or death in as little as 6 hours.
But researchers from Penn State recently found that temperatures as low as 87 degrees with 100% humidity could be life-threatening, even for healthy young people. The wet bulb temperature for older populations who are more vulnerable is likely lower.
As the planet warms, heat waves are becoming more frequent and intense, but a 2020 study found that over the last 40 years, heat combined with high humidity is also increasing.
And finally, if your vehicle is dirty enough to write "Wash Me" in the dust on its windshield, you might pop over to a car wash to clean it up.
But in the West, as the drought deepens, using lots of water to clean your ride might give you pause. Many commercial operations have reclamation systems that reuse water, so it requires only around 9 to 15 gallons of fresh water per car.
But water is precious, so what if you could use even less? That's the idea behind so-called waterless car washes, where you won't see loud machinery and suds going down a drain. Instead, a team armed with spray bottles cleans your car in a manner akin to dusting furniture.
And they come to you. One company called Future Wash, which was started in the San Francisco Bay Area in 2017, is not only about saving water, but also convenience. While you have a coffee or go to work, they'll clean your car with a proprietary solution they say contains biodegradable and eco-friendly ingredients and uses less than a cup of water per vehicle.
Future Wash is part of a growing trend in waterless car washes popping up around the country, including one called No H2O, which promotes itself as dry cleaning for cars. But if they're not in your area, you can buy products online and wash your car at home. No hose or tip required.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to James Swinson, Steve Miller, Alexis Kenyon, Hallie Zander, Rosanna Longo-Better, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halperin for their contributions.